Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Slacker Podcast. Phil Tiger, Slacker Podcast.
Greetings, Slackers. I hope you're all good. Hope you're all well. How are you? How are you really? Let's get down to the deep core of how you're doing. Well, obviously, you want to pass some time. That's why you've downloaded this podcast. I thank you very much for that. Hello to everybody who's new, who's just jumped on board on season two. We got like a massive influx of people over the last few weeks, and like the numbers of the podcast are like growing way more than like I don't know what I expected when I sort of started a podcast, but it's doing really well. So thank you very much for that. Thank you to everybody who's leaving nice comments and reviews and rating it. I think Apple featured it on their carousel on like episode 2, the Christine and the Queens one, and we've definitely had some randoms who've come in and listened to it for like 5 minutes. I think I got like a review last week which was just, this is gibberish. And to be fair, like when it comes to my introductions, he's not wrong. If you're joining in right now on this podcast and you're like a massive loyal Carner fan, let me introduce you to what the Slacker Podcast is all about. We get artists in, doesn't matter what genre, just as long as like I'm a massive fan of them, and there's an audience out there for people who want to hear what they sounded like at the very beginning. I try to get the earliest demo that I can get off them. The scratchier, the better. Some of them that we've had through sound like they were recorded on a dictaphone sellotape to the back end of a dog shelter, and other ones have pretty much sounded studio ready. So it's kind of like up to their discretion of what demo they bring in, because it's a really good place to start for like an interview and to like find out where an artist comes from. So far on this season's podcast, we've had Christine and the Queens and Bring Me the Horizon, Scroobius Pip, Fatboy Slim. And I don't want to really give away who we've got coming up, but we've got some amazing names and some of my favourite guests that we've had on so far. Speaking of which, this artist is called Loyal Carner. His album, his second album, is coming out on Friday this week. So if you're listening to this on Thursday when it comes out, then you'll stay up to midnight and listen to the record back to front. I think I might do that. If not, if you're listening to it way after that, then you should definitely go and listen to Loyal Carner, because everything that's come off it so far has been really good. He's got an incredible collaboration with Georgia Smith on that record. I know he does some work with Jordan Rakai, Tom Misch. And just when it comes to UK hip-hop, he offers up something completely different than what the UK is known for. Like, you know, the UK has some incredible MCs, but normally it's of the more sort of aggressive style of music, like drill music or grime music. When it comes to Loyal Carner, you know that he loves beats from people like Jay Dilla and Madlib, and he kind of loves all that like early roots maneuver stuff. I'm really into it. Like it's music with humanity and heart and soul, and like there's not too much of that about, and Loyal Carner just does it the best. So it was great to have him come in and get one of his early demos. I think the very first time I heard him was on a feature and on a Reggie Snow track from 2000 and blah, blah, blah. I can't even remember when it was. But it was good to have him come into the studio and sort of chat nonsense with me for a little bit. Also, as usual, this podcast is sponsored by my book. It's called Phil Taggart's Slacker Guide to the Music Industry. So if you're making music, if you're in a band, if you're a singer-songwriter, if you play the nose flute and you take your music seriously, then I have stuck together like a guide through 70 interviews to kind of help you on that journey, because it's very confusing if you're setting out to do it by yourself. So I interviewed people like Run the Jewels and Loyal Corner, of course, and Slaves, and just absolutely tons of people. And stuck it all in one place. So if you go to philtaggartslacker.com, you can order the book, you can order the ebook, it doesn't really matter. But that's it. Sponsored by that. And I think I can hear my front door going now, so I better run down and get it. This is the Slacker Podcast with Loyal Corner in 3, 2, 1. Who is it?
Someone wants 3 boxes of books at the door.
Right, that's me off. Right, here it is. Loyal Corner, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, so we have got our guest, Loyal Corner.
Yeah.
A.K.A. Ben. Woo-hoo. A.K.A. the king of South London.
Dog walking at South London.
A.K.A. the king of dog walking.
South London. Yeah, here I am.
You're like what Roy Keane is to dog walking to football to UK rap music.
Yeah. I think so. I hope so. The Roy Keane of rap. Jeez, I'll take that.
Oh my God, I'd take that all day long.
The Roy Keane of rap, whoa.
There's something to that.
Yeah.
What's going on, anyway? You well?
Yeah, chilling, man. I'm really nice, actually. I just had a banh mi, which was nice. Fish banh mi, so I'm feeling...
I don't even know what that is. Your culinary like prowess is like way above mine.
Vietnamese baguette, right? So it's really simple stuff. Uh-huh. It's because Vietnamese has a big, heavy influence with French. I don't know if it was colonized or whatever, but a long time ago, there's a big like French impact on Vietnamese cuisine. And so it's like a Vietnamese... All the flavours of Vietnamese food inside a French baguette. Serious.
God, that really puts my, like, beans on toast or whatever into context.
Crack beans.
People always think, like, I'm going to New York soon and, like, thinks, right, well, you go to America, you put on loads of weight.
Yeah, yeah.
Anytime I go to Paris, I put on way more weight.
Yeah, yeah, because of the cheese,
because of the cheese. Like,
cheese is dangerous.
Every morning for breakfast, a croque monsieur,
which
is, like, woo, cheese on the outside of the bread, cheese on the inside of the bread, and cheese on the outside of the bread.
It's ridiculous, man. It's just the cheesiest place.
I'm just coming back, like, pure bloated.
Yeah, yeah. You should go, if you're in New York, you should go to a place called Ivan Ramen. It's this, like, ramen chef who... He's like a hero, man. I met him, actually. I cried when I met him. I was
so lame.
But he was a proper hero of mine.
Yeah,
Basically, he was like, he's an American guy, and he was the first like white ramen chef to ever make an impact in Japan, be accepted by Japanese people as one of their
proper trailblazer.
Yeah, 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 yeah. He's a legend. Ivan Orkin.
I think that you can probably speak with as much confidence about food as you probably can music at this stage.
I think so. I don't know why. I've studied it kind of accidentally. Once I'd studied everything there was to know about rap by accident. I still have a lot to learn, I think, but I just started doing the same thing with TV shit, like cooking shows by accident. I just drink in. It's like those are the two things I can drink in information for.
That's it, just sticks?
Yeah, those are the only things. I don't have any kind of like useful knowledge I can tell you about like any 90s rapper or any niche like Lebanese chef. That's kind of where I sit.
So like at the start of every podcast, we play a demo or like the earliest thing that anybody will let us play. Some people are like going, nothing is opening that vault. Nothing is opening that vault. But I'm going to play this off my laptop. We're going to edit it in after. And we're going to play a demo from 6 years ago.
Jeez.
This is Loyal Corner and 11.
I haven't heard this for so long.
The Green leaves turn maroon as the wind claims he caught him. It's autumn, and he didn't want to lose us, so we bought him 2 tickets to the theatre, the National Waterloo. We knew we should have kept it simple, but simple just wouldn't do, because she was 17, but little redheaded, never been bedded before. Begging for more, but was stressing the court. Now, was he right? Was he your type? Did he want it every night? Or would they tangle once and then disappear out of sight? It wasn't quite unrequited, but was close enough. Known to hold a bluff, hoping he would open up when the clothes were off. But he never did, just another story. What's a porky to a pig? Now he was glorious with fibs, and that was that. Telling the lies and acting like it's fact, but leaving him less and less, because she knew it became a trap. But the gap to escape had merely turned into a crack, and it was at this very second she knew she weren't getting back. So they continued to kick it slow. I was on the side writing rhymes like I didn't know, but I knew, and it hurt, never let it show through. Didn't work, couldn't tell the truth that I told you. So listen, don't be caught up in their rise to glisten, because I've been in that.
That was Damo from Loyal Corner. That was 11. What goes through your head when you hear that further? I'm assuming the first time in a while, right?
Yeah. Do you know what? Like, it's weird because, like, I'm feeling it. But I had such a shit, like, rap voice. I used to put on, like, a kind of rappy voice when I was younger.
What was your, like, what do you mean?
I don't know. It doesn't sound as much like me as me. Do you know what I mean? I guess because I was younger, but it's kind of like I was trying to be, I don't know, just that. It's kind of like I'm forcing it out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's because I've done it so many times that when I used to record so much, like the same verse over and over again. It took me a long time to realize that, you know, after you said it a few times, you're not saying it for any reason. I'd still be like, yo, I've got to get it perfect. Every little bit's got, like, every nuance has got to be perfect. And I've got to sound like I'm crying here, and then I've got to laugh here. And then before I knew it, it meant nothing, you know?
It takes quite a long time to sort of grow into yourself and find your own voice.
Yeah.
I listen back to like an old radio show or something. Yeah. I'm like, my God, I sound like X. I sound like Z. I sound like Y. You're like, but I don't sound like me.
It's weird though, because I haven't listened to that for so long, probably in like 6 years. And it made me feel like I'm all right at rapping. I remember posting that on my Facebook when it came out, and some guy who remained nameless, like a musician, commented on it like, sick bars, shit beat. And I was like,
you're like, well, like, did you make the beat on that?
No. So like, some guy who also remained nameless because it's not fair, but I just remember thinking, you wait, one day I'll be all right. Here I am.
Well, what do you do like when you start out as a rapper and you know that you've got bars and you've got stuff to say? Like, how do you go about finding those beats and getting everything to that sort of recording stage? Do you buy them online? Do you find people on SoundCloud? Or
it's
like,
kind of just, like, I don't know. To be honest, man, everyone I knew that I was growing up around had, like, a few 16s. Do you know what I mean? So it wasn't even, like, even if you could rap, it was, like, nobody really cared if you could rap, because everybody could rap. Do you know what I mean? So I think it was difficult to get, I'm not saying your foot in the door, but it was just really people that you were hanging out with. You just had to try and be lucky enough to be with someone who had a mic or someone who had this, and even if you didn't really like him, you were still kind of like, yo, what's up, man, can I come around? So yeah, but yesterday at school you said you hated me, man. It's like, yeah, but I didn't know you had a mic then. But yeah, I don't know, I guess like for me, I had I just was in conversation with a few people and they get sent beats and they wouldn't like them, and I was always just getting like the worst beat from the batch, so they'd like go, oh, I got sent these beats from so and so.
You were getting the relegation
beats.
Yeah,
I like all of these, you can have this one. Yeah. And I was like, okay, but I didn't have any beats, and you know, I didn't want to go down the route of just doing the whole jumping on some of my favourite Mobb Deep beats and whatever, because these are all beats I love, but they've been, I've always found it kind of weird because every beat that I love, usually from a rap song, has a good rap to go with it already. And so, you know, I'm not trying to like,
yeah, you don't want to jump on somebody else's.
Yeah, thing. I wasn't trying to step on anyone's toes, or you know, I appreciate things for what they are. Do you know what I mean? Like, when I was supposed to do my Fire in a Booth ages ago, I really wanted to use a Common beat instrumental, because Common's like my hero.
Yeah.
Proper hero. But every beat I listened to, I couldn't get his rhymes out of my head, and so I couldn't write to them, and also everything I did write just didn't feel good as good. Didn't feel good enough to be on his beat.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I kept writing, and nothing felt like it was like worthy to be on those.
It's like pulling on the shirt, isn't it? Putting on the number 7 shirt of your favourite football team.
And for real.
You have to earn it, don't you?
Exactly that. It just felt like, you know, I guess, so I was really kind of particular with beats. I used to just, you know, just only be like, yo, can I have it? Has anyone else heard it? Is anyone else using it? And if anyone else had even had it on their computer, I was like, yo,
like, no,
don't want it. Yeah.
Not for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you say that, like, you know, everybody around your like age, there was like, lots of people, like they had their own 16 bars, whether it was beats or whether it was rhymes or whatever. Yeah. But like when you'd say that to me, without like knowing you now, like if you say, oh, I'm from London, I've got 16 bars, the first thing that goes through my head is like, oh, it's a grime MC.
You don't
automatically think, oh, okay, it's going to be like, you know, UK hip hop.
But I think that's the thing about it, because even in my head, I don't think of those two things as any different, which is interesting. I mean, I kind of think of, when I had 16s when I was younger, I had some faster ones and some slower ones. I, at the time, wasn't kind of intellectualizing it to the point where I was thinking, I have some hip-hop rhymes and I have some grime rhymes and I got some garage rhymes. I just had rhymes.
And you never fucked up with a grime?
No, I did for sure. I had grime. I had loads of grime tunes, and I still have grime tunes on my computer. New ones, do you know what I mean? I love grime. And I prefer garage beats, really. Like, it's kind of almost the same tempo, but just it's kind of got a bit more swing to it, and I find it easier to rap to those kind of beats. But, like, I've always had verses for every kind of... I don't know, instrumental, like, bed, do you know what I mean? Like, from 90 BPM or, like, 70 all the way up to 140, do you know what I mean? But the beats I was getting at school were hip-hop beats. And the people around me, like, what was kind of growing at the time was, like, people were kind of digging back. I know you know when you go to school, everyone's kind of looking back because no one wants to be doing what's current. Everyone's like, yeah, you lot are listening to this current stuff. I'm going to listen to some old stuff.
And yeah, exactly. I'm going to see where it came from.
Just so happened it was, like, old school hip-hop that I, like, fell in love with. And, you know, I would just lose myself for days and days and days on the scroll bar on YouTube. And then that was it. I'd get locked into it. And I just would disappear into, like, a hole of rap. And, like, every day I was discovering more, and what was the beauty of it is there was just so much more to get out of it, you know?
It's weird you say that, because, like, you would have been a teenager when you were going through all of that, and, like, you know, you're still, like, what, 24 years old, like a young man. The concept of new music, people think that, a lot of places think that young people just listen to new music, whereas I don't think that's true at all.
Desperate for something that's not new, do you know what I mean? But I guess, like, I felt when I was younger, I was desperate for something that was my own, do you know what I mean? So I find all these, like, niche, like, there's a rap group called The Alcoholics, right? And they had this one beat that was produced by Madlib. And I found the beat first, and then, like, a month later, just on YouTube, I then heard the tune, and I was like, oh, this is that beat that I love. And yeah. I had to take away my rhymes from it, because... obviously someone had put some good raps
you're
on
gonna
it
get but, copyright.
But yeah, I was just so desperate for something that I could bring to people, be it at school or be it at home, mainly at home. I mean, I don't really care about people in my club. I wasn't trying to impress them, really, a little bit, but
there is a little bit about it,
like, yeah, but know, I kind of had to get over that, because it wasn't worth it, and I'm not an impressive guy, so I'd be like, yo you heard this, and they go, yeah man, fuck off, go away, go get some crisps. But, like, when I was at home, I'd be like to my dad, yo, check this out. And so I was kind of digging back for something that he would never hear on the radio. To my mum, like, you'd never hear this, you know. And it was a lot of grime as well, but I don't know, like, I used to watch Channel U, I used to watch MTV Base, I used to watch what's the other one, Flavor with an A.
Yeah.
And, like, before I knew it, I was, like, well versed in all of this music. But they'd play Skinny Man, then they'd play Kano, then they'd play, like, Pow, the first, like, the remix,
Lethal Bizzle.
So it's like, yeah, do you know what I mean? Or More Fire Crew or whatever.
These are all
the same things. Oh, it was Lethal Bizzle, but then, yeah, More Fire Crew's after. And then, like, all these things are coming at the same time. And they're all, to me, they're all just, it's all just rap, do you know what I mean? So I'm not hearing it and going, that's a rap tune, that's a grime tune. I'm going, like, these guys all look like me, they all sound like me. They're just rapping different styles. Like hip-hop, like 90s hip-hop is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You have some guys like Q-Tip who sounds like this. And then, you know, you have, like, Bun B and Pimp C who are kind of slower on some West Coast stuff sounding like this. And that was just how it was.
There's a freshness to that, like, old school hip hop sound that, like, has never died. And I got me thinking yesterday when I was doing my radio show, because it was like 30 years to almost to the day that De La Soul released 3 Feet High and Rising.
That's,
like,
so mad.
That's a 30 year old album.
I was minus
album.
Six.
And we stuck on I Know.
Yeah.
And I just thought, like, this does not sound dated.
No.
You know when
you
listen to, like, some indie rock tunes,
even
stuff from, like, the 2000s or whatever, right?
Sounds that,
and you're like, it sounds like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like, there's something, there's like an agelessness to those beats.
You know, I think it is because it could, like, I don't know, not all of it is sample heavy, but there's, like, the beauty of the samples is because, you know, that's timeless music that they're sampling, because it's the way I feel that sampling must have come about. You know, from documentaries I've watched and books I've read and chats I've had, you know, I feel like, it, you know, Q-Tip was saying at one point, he was like, you know, the reason we're sampling is because we don't have any instruments, you can't afford any of this or any of that, but my dad had a record player, and so I record, you know, one sample, then I record one beat. But if your dad has it, it has to be, and your dad likes music or whatever, then it has to be of some quality. And that song's probably already been around for 60 years, and if that song's been around for 60 years and it's still popping, if you flip it, it's going to be around another 60 years, do you know what I mean? Because you're just taking that same song and giving it new, even more life. even kind of more relevance, I think. But like, that was the beauty of it for me.
If you look at like Warren G Regulate, right?
Yeah, big thing.
But you think, right, most people go hear that song and they're like, oh, wow, that's great. Yeah, yeah. But that's an old Michael McDonald track, right? And that's like so, like the most middle of the road AM American record.
Yeah. But
and that's ultimate flip.
But yeah, but what's so interesting about it though is like the potential for that tune, because when you hear it, like even when I hear it now, I've got the original on one playlist.
Yeah.
And when I hear the original, I hear the Warren G, but then also when I hear Warren G, I hear the original. And I feel like they're one and the same, but I feel like, I don't know, it's kind of through listening to hip hop or whatever, when you think about making beats or something, that you start to grow this ear for songs that have a potential or a certain thing. And yeah, there's loads of songs like that, I don't know, as much as they weren't designed for this purpose, I think even if Warren G hadn't have flipped it, okay, it wouldn't have necessarily gone as far as it had gone, but if anyone who heard it would have gone, oh, what's this? They wouldn't have been like, oh, I can't imagine using that, you know? But I think that's the innovation. I think that's where, like, you know, they said there's no technique or something, it's not craft, you know? Like, talk about guys like Madlib, who's like arguably my favourite producer that's alive right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, the guys might just loop something, but it's about hearing the right part to flip and loop and, you know, make timeless, you know?
The one thing that, like, you get with hip-hop fans is, like, they're not holier than thou. When you, like, have a metal fan, they won't listen to anything else. Or, hellbent for metal, man.
Or if you're
into techno, they won't even listen to house music. It's just techno. Yeah. But because of the sample culture of hip-hop, like, you're ultimately opened up to funk and disco and old soul records and jazz.
But this is the thing, is it's pushed even further now, because like then you go, right, everyone's sampling jazz. Everyone's like guys like Madlib or whatever, or guys like Havoc from Mobb Deep, rest in peace, Prodigy, or you know, like these guys, or even Ninth Wonder. They go, everyone's fucking sampling jazz, so I'm gonna start sampling prog rock, or I'm gonna start trying to sample the intros of some metal tunes, or I'm gonna start looking at reggae, and then because they start doing it, you start hearing it, then you start moving with it. Like on this Jay Dilla album that came out, The Diary, the one after he passed, he was flipping like, what's that you hear in my car? I can't feel safest.
Oh, it was Gary Newman.
He flips that and turns it to hear in my truck. It's mad. It sounds wild. And it's not the one that I bumped the most on that album, but the fact that he sampled it has forced people who would never have heard that song
or even
approached that genre of music to go, oh, actually, I'll give that a go. And I think that's always been the beauty of hip-hop anyways, is I don't know, like for me it was like my gateway into
different places,
the other kind of music, from like Indian theme song, like Bollywood movies, to then, you know, just all the way coming back through Nigerian, like I don't know, desert soundtrack.
You get loads of sci-fi with MF Doom and stuff like that.
It's just you're digesting culture and fiction, you know.
I find that's why I'm starting to like lose a lot of interest in like drill and trap music, because it's just it's becoming two dimensional to me.
The
I mean the trap beats have like, I've been playing them on the radio since like I started on the radio. And the trap beat's been, you know, like that rolling hi-hat or whatever has been very popular for a long time.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the last 18 months to 2 years, it's become crossover and it's become mainstream.
I get,
if I never heard Migos Again now, I wouldn't bat an eyelid.
It's the soul, I think, sometimes that's missing, you know, because like I hear tunes like there's a Fredo tune I heard the other day. I think it's One to His Mum, and a sample on that is so beautiful. And so it's a Fredo. I like Fredo. Do you know what I mean? Like Fredo represents is that the same way I like Fredo? The same way I like gangster films like The Godfather, because he represents the life that I don't live.
Yeah.
So I enjoy it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But like, I don't know when that's kind of how it's supposed to be done. Do you know what I mean? Because it's whatever genre of music or this or that doesn't mean it can be void of soul. I think sometimes it can become really easy to recreate a beat. So say like one type of beat becomes successful, right? And if you're kind of, you know, props to whoever, if you don't have much...
Like that Afro Bashman sound has been big for a long time.
Because it becomes at the start, it's innovative, and then it becomes like, oh, yo, we could make one of these. And then before you know it, there's another video popping up on Jerome Daly or whatever.
And then you hear like ex-pop band from the major label start using that.
And that's the thing. And then as soon as that starts happening, it has to grow again. You know, it has to evolve. I think that's the annoying thing, is that like it grows out of something, like out of the concrete, you know, in a beautiful, like J-Hus with kind of was like steering the boat on that sound for a little while. I'm not necessarily the first person to do it, but the first person to take it into this mainstream without being a mainstream artist, right?
Yeah.
And then as soon as people latch onto that and go, right, we want to do that as well, the difficulty is then having to be like, okay, cool, I created that, or I was innovating with that. Leave that now. You lot are having that. What's the next thing? What can I be doing next? And that's the difficulty, you know, if you are coming up from a place where you don't have much. And I know it, you know, just because I wasn't out doing as naughty things doesn't mean I came from a place that had a lot. I didn't have a lot. And I understand the idea of going, I don't have anything. Shit, well, if this guy makes a beat and it does this, I've got two beats that sound just the same. I'll do one of those, yeah. You know? And it's the fear is the innovation because, you know, like, I think drill music, when I first started hearing it, because obviously I started hearing it when it was from Chirac and the Chicago stuff, and
yeah.
You start hearing that, then it comes over here, and it's like the thing that's got its finger on exactly what's happening right now for these kids. But then that has to evolve, do you know what I mean? It can't, because that's not how they're feeling still right now. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. I think that's but the scary thing is to go, right, who's going to take that first step to go, actually, this is what we're feeling now. And this is the kind of beat that represents how we feel, you know?
The music's representing the sort of social strife.
Yeah.
The same way that punk music did in the
70s. Yeah, 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 yeah. But punk evolved.
And the same way that
rave
culture did in the early 90s.
But they evolved. That's the thing is, I think that's the importance. And what has to be remembered is that, you know, you don't get... I would always rate any musician, especially in hip-hop, rap, drill, trap, grime, garage, whatever, that it is just going, all right, I see what you lot are doing and I like it and I'm doing it as well, but now I'm just going to push it a bit further and do this. And if it doesn't work, then it's like, yeah, it didn't work, but, you know.
See, that's why I like Dave. Dave can come in with a hard track and then he can go, do you know what, I'm shit hard at piano.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Dave is an enigma, man.
I don't know where he's come out of.
He's very brave with music. And also, you know, you can't underestimate the responsibility that guy has. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
Like, there's,
especially recently. Like,
yeah, and he's expected, yeah. He's expected to, I don't know. Like, I've met him a few times. I chatted to him. And we're cool.
Yeah.
To an extent. I mean, I don't know him. Like, we're not best mates. But yeah. I know him, and I really rate him as a person and as a musician. And, like, it's clear the pressure that guy has, because he's an incredible musician, right? And he's an incredible rapper, yeah? He's young. But he's one of the few kids who's expressed, you know, that he's switched on, right? And he's forward-thinking and he understands the pitfalls with drug culture, gang culture, you know, idolizing criminals, selling drugs, whatever, all the stuff. But then also, you know, he's had tough times, whatever. But, like... the responsibility on his back to reflect, like, the responsibility for these young kids who are hearing it, because if he says a certain thing, they might do that certain thing or they might not do that certain thing, you know. And I can't imagine that pressure. And so to be able to have all of that going on in your head and still be able to innovate and push and keep creating is, you know, like, I take my hat off to him, because sometimes no one listens to my shit. I don't know if people listen to my shit or not. Like, sometimes,
you know, they definitely do.
But sometimes, but I never know. Every time I put it in, I'm not going, this tune's certified. Do you know what I mean? This tune's
Do you feel that pressure when you put the pen to the paper?
No, because I don't think, not every time I'm going to put a song out, everyone's going to go, right, this is a sick song. But, like, Dave, regardless if it's a sick song or if it's a song that he's not as proud of.
It's scrutinized.
Yeah, yeah, because the world is watching. Do you mean the world's not necessarily watching me? So I have a bit more freedom to go, I'll try that. Let's see if they like it or not. Do you mean? Or let's see if the radio play this or not. Do you mean? But with him, it's like, whatever he puts out, every single move has to be so calculated, which is cool, but it can stunt creativity. And so what I'm saying is that it should stunt his creativity, but it just seems to make it even, like, it just doubles it, trebles it.
Yeah.
Which is wicked to see. You know, a guy from South, he grew up in, like, close to it, like, basically where I spent all my time at my grand's house in Brixton. He was in Streatham, so... Do you know what I mean? He's like, from where I'm from, and he's, you know, doing something that I've always seen, but I never saw it go that far. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's incredible. He's got a song with Drake. You know, and as much as that's a small thing, and it's whatever, and it's pressure on him. And
what do you do if Drake hits your phone?
If me?
Yeah.
I'd be like, you must have the wrong number. There's no way. Come on, man. You know, like, I've got a family that need to eat.
People don't turn down Drake.
No, of course not. But, you know, also, it's an unpopular opinion, but Drake can rap, you know?
Yeah.
When Drake was only a rapper, I remember me and Rebel Clef used to sit all the time and just go, why? And then we'd hear new tunes and go, why is he not just doing this? Why is he not rapping more? But, you know,
he's got two sides to him as well. He's got the sort of soulful crooner side.
He's got that
kind of, like, you know, he's, like, obviously got this fascination with, like, UK culture.
He just, like, the BBK tattoo and all the rest.
He just wants to, like, you know, front up.
Yeah, but I think, you know, you can't underestimate the fact that a kid who's 19, 20, from an area that I grew up in, you know, where when we were growing up there, like, rap music was, you know, we had guys like Kano. Kano's one of the best rappers in the world ever. So is Jest. in my opinion. So is Getz. Do you know what I mean? And like lyrically, could go toe to toe. I feel like with some of the best from America, right? And even guys like Jay-Z have co-signed Kano from way back.
Yeah.
But there
yeah.
was never any sniff of someone having a tune with the biggest, like, and he's not even a rapper. Just Drake. Drake is a pop star. I mean, Drake is an international superstar, and Dave from Streatham has a tune of him.
But I feel it like your rap music almost transgresses like just UK culture, because if you say the words UK rap, right,
yeah.
you probably think of somebody like Giggs, yeah. or you probably think of somebody like Krepton Conan,
yeah, okay.
right?
Yeah.
But I like feel like, you know, your music feels more global. Like it doesn't feel like it's just UK.
Yeah. Weird because when I was making my first album, especially, and with this one as well, it's kind of been the same thing. Is I tried to work, especially production with producers and musicians, was all English people, and it British people, and it wasn't like, you know, you had to be white with brown hair and drink tea. It was like, you know, it just had to be people who were from here, not from the States, because I think, you know, I'm so inspired and so influenced by American hip-hop rap culture that I didn't want, you know, to lose myself as I started to work with people and start going, oh, yeah, and start saying words I didn't really understand or whatever. So it was important for me to do that. But I don't know. I've always felt like it was really UK, but I hear what you're saying. I just think maybe sometimes, you know, because there's not as much scrutiny on me, sometimes I can just, oh yeah, who cares? Maybe this isn't a rap song, but
the first time I ever heard you on a track was actually on Reggie Snow's.
'92.
You featured on that.
Yeah.
And like Reggie's an Irish artist who
went
out and lived in LA. He had a football scholarship.
Yeah. I know. It's crazy. I remember him telling me that. This is a long time ago, but yeah.
And Reggie drifts between, like, he's got a thick Irish accent. He drifts between having a little bit of an American twang as well.
Yeah.
But so like he's kind of like in that sort of
that buttery like. But that's the thing, is also it's place. About knowing like where you sit and if you have a voice for it. Like, I can't have a voice for it to be, I don't know. I like, it's weird. I've just, whatever I've heard, I've always of myself, I listen back to myself. I kind of, you know, I just worry that people around me will be like, you don't say that, you don't sound like that, you don't, you know, you don't do that. So, you know, so that's why a lot of the things I've always had to be like,
you start saying like aluminum and like elevator
in it.
I want to go back to the kind of almost the start. Like, did you pick up your talent for writing rap music? Do you reckon you got that from your mom? She's a bit of a writer. Yeah. She's got like a sort of poetic side.
Yeah, for sure. She was in a band called Genie and the Giants years ago, and she was like a writer. My auntie is a poet, and they, you know, were both poets together, and they would like write and sing. And my mom kind of had to give it up. She gave birth to me. And I don't know, I kind of probably always felt like a weird like debt to her, you know, because she chose me
over the quill.
Over the quill, do you know what I mean? Over the Grammys. But yeah, do you know what? My mom definitely got it from my granddad. And that's who, you know, this next record is completely inspired by my granddad in his poetry book. And I think it was interesting looking at it and then talking to my mom about it, because, you know, those two have such similarities with the way they write. And then my manager Tomo, my good friend Tomo, he was like, he can see a lot of influence on me. And I think it's true. I think that they're my biggest inspirations, because my granddad was always reciting poetry to me, like Stevie Smith's poetry and his own. And, you know, then my mum starts reciting my granddad's poetry to me, and then all this, it's kind of like little kind of, because my granddad was Scottish, so he'd give me like little tales about how he'd come to London and meet the Queen, and
yeah,
you know, and she'd like get him to paint his bits green. I don't like, you know, that's a real poem. His toodaloo was dirty, so he took it to the Queen, and she gave him a sixpence to have it painted green. It's one of my favourites that he told me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's where my biggest inspiration was, that poem.
But like, the thing about being like recited poetry to at that age, and like your mum being into it, means that I assume in your house that you were never like dumbed down to, like, that you would have been spoken to as an adult.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't, like, my mom was kind of like that as well. And because she never, like, dumbed words down, I'd have to ask what they were. So I didn't actually read that much as a kid, but ended up with a really big vocabulary.
Yeah, for sure. Same.
For no reason.
Yeah. But I think that's the beautiful thing about it. So I was like, I was like that early.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As kid as well, and they say when you're the first kid or you don't have a sibling, you have to socialize with older people a lot more, right? So if you're a twin, then you and your twin, it doesn't mean that they don't develop, but they have, like, they can kind of get away with just going, like, in their own language or chatting, and they develop things like the sign language, which is fascinating stuff. But when you're a single child, you're the first child and you're the first one in the house, you're kind of like, it's either you chat to your gran or your granddad or their, your mum's friends, or yeah, you know, or whatever, when you're out and about, or you just don't talk. So if I didn't chat to my mum, I can't sit in the back seat and chat to my brother before he was born, you know. So for the first 7 years of my life, it was just me and my mum, and so that's who I chatted to. Yeah, and she was obviously a lot brighter than me.
You had, like, well, like, you know, I have ADHD, so like for being a kid for 7 years,
yeah,
sort of not on your own, sitting about, man, it sucks, not saying anything. That shit's tough.
It's like, impossible, man.
I was like an only kid, and I lived out in the country, so there was no kids even about.
That's
so
horrible.
I used to, like, kick the football about and pretend to be all 11 players in the football team. Do you know what I mean? What were the records in your house that your, like, mum and your dad and your granddad were playing and stuff like that?
My granddad used to love Frank Sinatra.
Oh, man.
He used to love Frank Sinatra, man. And
chairman of the board.
Yeah. Smooth operator.
Yeah.
But my mum and my dad, so my mum and my dad, you know, they used to listen to kind of everything. There's a lot of funk and soul, a lot of blues, a lot of guitar heavy stuff as well, but kind of, you know, like, kind of a lot of your obvious stuff, like Beatles, Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan, David Bowie, Prince, you know, kind of just all the good stuff, kind of all the stuff that when you think about a cool parent. Or like
sounds like they, like, should have had a show on Six Music.
Yeah. Basically, basically Six Music. Basically, Mark Bringham was Six Music, and that's why I love it there so much, because when I go there, they go, "Yo, what tunes you want to play?" And I just go, "I'll play these tunes on one play."
Right? Yeah, you've had a show.
I've had a few. I'm trying to take over from Craig Charles. I'm not joking. They just need someone who looks just like him. So they're like, "Yeah, why don't you come along?"
Oh yeah, I totally forgot. Like, yeah, you've done a couple of shows on Six Music.
It's easy because I play the songs that I listen to in my house when, like, my mum's house before I moved out. Like, and that it comes, it's not, don't have to think about it, and but it goes down so well. And I think it's just because what's nice about that as well is it makes me feel like there's loads of people who grew up in the same kind of family situations as me, you know, like those kind of kids go, "Yo, that's what my mum and dad used to play." And I go, "Yeah, same." And then the parents are going, "Yo, that's what I played with my kids and when they were growing up."
The idea of touching people all across the nation through the tunes that you're playing is incredible.
That's what you're doing.
You need to cover for me next time I'm off. I'm allowed to pick my own record, so you'd be allowed to pick
yours. Oh, nice. Okay, sick. Yeah, we'll I'll do that happen. Then. That's the deal. Sounds like I have to do any, like, "Yo, here's some tunes that I should be saying I'm picking, but I'm not really picking."
Yeah, no, that's all right, man. I'm legit. We're allowed to pick our own.
Sick.
I'm just trying to take you back off Six. You're too young. Take you back over to Radio 1. What was the, like, out of those, like, records and stuff that they were playing, like, what was the one that you latched onto and you were like, "Oh, right, this is a bit of me, this one"?
Oasis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hard not to.
The first ever song that I learned or sung was Wonderwall.
A lot of music tests and exams and stuff have been Wonderwall. I think I did that in, like, third year.
Yeah. It's an incredible song. But, like, just that again is, like, you know, because I don't, this might sound a bit rogue and I might just be talking shit because I'm rolling off my impulses right now. But, like, I watched the documentary, Supersonic, is it?
Yeah.
And I was watching my missus, and we were on the train home from Edinburgh. We had, like, a little argument and we made up, and then we were going back as, like, after New Year's. Typical.
Yeah.
And then we're rolling back and we start watching it, like, and, like, the way that Noel was writing, it like, there's something about it that it wasn't not punk, do you know what I mean, in terms of a punk music, it's not hip hop, do you know what I mean, but it had something in it that was like so full of soul and so like, I would defy anyone who grew up in, you know, a situation like me or you know, 10 times worse, which is usual, you know, because I didn't have the worst time, but I didn't have the best time, to not relate to it, or at least kind of go, you know, this guy's pouring his heart out, and the beauty of him writing it and then his brother singing it and kind of like capturing his brother's anguish only he could, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and,
exactly, because yeah. Noel's the soul, but Liam's the punk.
Yeah, exactly, and you need those together, and I think that was the thing that, for me, I latched onto it, because I was like, well, these guys, this is real, like, it's real shit, they're not just talking bollocks, and even if it's kind of like braggadocious, or you know, when they're talking about champagne supernova in the sky, it's like that, like, just it's the feeling of being that, like, yeah. I want to be that, do you know what I mean, like,
do you feel it, like, because, like, what was it last night, I mean, we were recording this in at the beginning of March, and Liam was having a go at Noel because he signed to a major record label and stuff, and like, yeah. he's constantly like, you know, yeah, like a terrier, nipping at him, yeah. And like the part of me is just going, he's only just doing that because he really like wants to get Oasis back together.
Yeah. I just think, I mean, they need to fucking get together. I supported Liam Gallagher, yeah, in where was it, in Finsbury Park, like last summer.
I was at that show.
Yeah, I was there. You missed it. I was early. It was like me just before Wolf Alice, right?
Yeah, and I landed in the middle of Wolf Alice.
Yeah, cheers, mate.
Sorry, man.
Yeah, so it was carnage, man. It was just before it was the World Cup, innit? So
there was a guy standing during that set, yeah. who was completely and utterly bollock naked, with nothing on, drinking a bottle of wine, and not even like pretending, going, look at me.
Yeah.
That's how fucking mental that one was.
Man, that we came out and everyone was just going, it's coming home. And we heard there was a group on before us, like an Australian group, I don't know who they were, but they literally got, not booed off, they got like chanted off, because they just couldn't, they kept trying to play their songs, and halfway through their song, someone would just go, it's coming home. And then it would erupt through the whole, so yeah. I got away with it, but I digress. I can't remember exactly what I was talking about supporting, but I just remember being like around it and thinking, like, I don't know, just he's a cool guy, but also he's not a cool guy, you know, and I would love the idea of them coming back together, but I think sometimes you just have to let it be, do you know what I mean? I think, you know, even if they got back together again, would it be the same? You know, these guys sometimes can perfectly capture a special moment.
But the idea of it getting back together is probably more, almost as exciting now as if they actually did it.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is like, if they said they did, I go, oh my God. But then I guess it's the pressure, because, you know, I get it from them, you know, if you're sitting on a gold mine and you'd both always be revered as legends and geniuses, and no matter what they do now, what they were sat on, this was such incredible music and such, you know, like captured a generation and a country, a world, do you know what I mean, at the time. So what? They touched it. So what? Noel Gallagher hates jazz. That's not so what, because I saw his interview about how he hates jazz, and he fucking vexed.
Yeah, but if they turn around in about 10 years' time and just say that this whole thing was like a massive PR campaign, and Liam and Noel were actually on the phone to each other going, wait, what will we tweet tonight?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
That's the most genius thing I think I've ever seen.
I wouldn't be surprised, man, you know? I wouldn't be surprised. What
was the first job you ever had?
My first and only job was a waiter. I wanted to get a job. I was dropping out of uni. Was my plan. Actually, no, this before that. Actually, I was trying to get a job as a preparation chef at Honest Burgers, and then I ended up, they said there's no chance. I was like, all I want to do is, I just want to get in the kitchen. However I can get in the kitchen, get me in the kitchen. And my mum's friend, close friend, like my godmother. If my mum was religious, then I would have been like this. She would have been my godmother. So that kind of woman.
Yeah.
She was like, my daughter's boyfriend is set up this one little burger restaurant.
Yeah.
Check it out. So I go down to Honest Burgers. This is before Honest Burgers was like huge everywhere, right? It's the first ever one. And I go, you know, we'd like to get you down. So I go, thinking I'm going to be a chef. And then I started being a waiter and I was horrible at it. Awful.
I stuck you back into the kitchen.
Yeah, my maths was rubbish. Like, I used to like charge, because you had to work out the bill. There was no like card machine there. You had to do it all by cash and whatever. So I used to have to work out the bill like with mental maths, and I just couldn't do it, and I used to undercharge people all the time, and they'd obviously just leave. And then one time I went downstairs to get a bottle of wine, and as I opened the fridge, like 10 bottles of champagne flew out over my head and smashed. And I didn't go upstairs and tell anyone or ask for help, because I was embarrassed, but I didn't know whether to tidy up, and so I kind of just stayed down there for like 5-10 minutes, and then by the time I did that, the boss came down and he was like, what the fuck are you doing down here with all this broken wine?
See, but you should have just styled it out and had one and be drinking
sorry,
it's my birthday.
But instead I was left in trouble. But yeah, that's
insane. I did the sort of preparation, not a preparation chef, but I did all the back stuff for like McDonald's for a week.
What?
Yeah, like I didn't get sacked, but there was a very angry sort of manager guy who, like, when I was putting the fish fillet the wrong way around or putting the wrong stuff in it, he would just, like, openly just go, "I kill you, I just had a panic attack, and I was like, "Mate, this is not worth it. I'm off."
It's such a mad conveyor belt working in a place like that.
What about, like, Brit School? What was that like?
Yeah, it was cool, man. I was studying theatre there. I went there mainly because I was having a tough time. I went to a private school before that. I got in on a scholarship, which kind of already made me feel like a bit of an odd one out because there was some super rich people there. And, you know, when you get
that class, that class divide is
it's difficult
as a teenager as well, when you're older, it doesn't matter as much who's got a lot of money, who doesn't.
Also, because you have a chance to generate your own worth and personality, and, you know, but right then you're just kind of living, like, you're kind of being judged on what your parents do. So, you know, I go play football and the rich kid, like, his dad's coming, they're getting boots for him, and then you don't have new boots, or you get new boots but you kind of get the Diadora ones or the Reebok ones, and he's got the new Nike.
The Diadora Puma ones used to be the cheap ones, now they're mad expensive.
Yeah, that's such bollocks, man, because it makes me so sad, because Puma was, like, kind of obtainable.
I love the Puma ones. Yeah, they were, like, keeping it real.
And then now it's, like, to get the Puma ones, it's just the same. They're just the same. Good for them, though. Good marketing.
Yeah, fair.
But, I don't know. It was weird. But when I went to Brit, I was kind of, like, excited to be around. Also, I had ADHD, and I was struggling. And they had me on meds at the school, and I was really against them. And, like, the meds are super, super I'll go into that after, because I'll forget my other point, but... I was on the meds. I wasn't happy with it. And so I went to Brit and I wanted to do theatre because theatre I didn't need to write. I was fascinated by Shakespeare. I was fascinated by poetry and the power of words and the spoken word. And I just wanted to study it. Do you know what I mean? So I did that. I did English A-level. And then I did my other academia. But I was kind of just there to hang out, to have a good time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in the end, I've kind of realised that not everyone was kind of as down for it as I was. Or as I expect. Some people were just there to kill time. I was there kind of going, yo, this is my passion.
I'm blessed to be here.
Yeah, yeah, for real. And don't get me wrong, I was messing around probably the most. I got in a lot of trouble, but not malicious trouble. No, like, aggression or, like, fights or whatever. Just, like, stupid things like snowballs and waterballs, you know?
Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, that's, like,
heartbreaking.
The thing is, being a teenager and being a young man, like sort of just after puberty, you've got expendable energy all over the show.
All the time.
You mix that with ADHD, and you're like a Molotov cocktail.
That was the beauty of being there. But the best thing about it was meeting people. Like, was meeting people who were making music. Some I'm cool with now, actually barely any. But, you know, but, like, at least I had spaces to get, you know, to find, like, oh, you make music, show me how to record this or do that.
But even that just interaction of being able to, like, do that and hang out.
That was the thing, is just meeting, because when I was at other school, no one was creative like that. So it was, you know, like, oh, what'd you do? And I was like, oh, I want to dance, or I want to rap, or I want to act. Or, you know, it's like, bruv, no one does that here, man. We're trying to be bankers and we're trying to get paid. And I was like, but I want to do those things, you know. I was like, oh, geezer, we're playing rugby, and I didn't want to play rugby. And so it was like, where do I sit in this? You know, so at least I could go there and get away with it. But it was weird because, again, you know, music to me then was really, again, still just fun. As was the theatre thing, but theatre, I was thinking maybe I'll become a playwright or something, you know, or maybe I'll get into it. And I wasn't rubbish at it, the whole world of theatre. So that was what I was gunning for.
Did dyslexia make it hard for you to, like, learn lines and things like that?
I think it actually kind of made me, because it kind of, there's something interesting about it. So, like, apparently, like, MI5 or MI6 or whatever it is, or CIA, they were looking for people with ADHD, Asperger's, autism, dyslexia. Because
are you going to tell me you're a secret agent?
Yeah, yeah, I am. I'm like Agent Cody Banks.
Revealed.
Yeah. No, yeah, I've been compromised. No, but they look for people who think outside the box, right? And so as much as it was difficult for me, I had my own ways of doing things. So I could actually pick up, like, learn lines. You know, if anyone wants me to be in any films, please. You know, this is my time to
hit me up.
Please, James Bond. Yeah. No, but I could learn them like that just because I'll just run it through my head. It's the same as writing rhymes. I mean, I already kind of had the correct disposition to be able to do that. I don't know. It was like a particular way of doing things that I found worked for me, which I think is different for everyone. You know, you can only do certain things. But when it came to, like, writing creatively, I could do it. But writing, like, academically or critically, I couldn't do. So if I'm writing about, you know, trying to pick apart one of Shakespeare's sonnets, I can't do that. But then I can, like, I don't know, can write my own one, and then in reference to it or in influence from it, you know.
Like, I just finished writing, like, a book, and it's like 100,000 words. Wow. And the bits I could do really easily was the bit where I had opinions and stuff, and I could talk freely about this, that, and the other. But then I've got, like, loads fact of amazing when it got fact based, like fucking hell.
Yeah.
It was like I just had to get somebody in to like help me figure it out.
You do
it was
though,
just
because
like, what do I do?
Because it's just not, I don't know, for me facts is not, I'm not interested by that. That's why me and my missus are a perfect combo, because she's like, she's all about the facts. And I've got like good pointless.
That
like,
means she remembers when you fucked up.
Yeah.
It's like on the 12th of June.
Yeah. She does. She always wins. But you know, then I kind of have the, I've got the waffle. So when we, you know, we chat to people, I can give the waffle, and then she goes, and here's the cold hard evidence. I mean, so together we're a good team. Well, really, really, she'd be good on her own, but
like
I'm lucky to have her. Basically, is what I'm saying. Yeah.
What was it like getting into like the music industry and like sort of dealing with like getting your first manager and booking agents and like labels and because you know the freedom of going sitting in your room and making beats and writing over beats and stuff it changes
I mean
it becomes a different beast.
Like at first it was kind of fun, like I think you expect loads of things to change. Like a lot of people around me who are still around me now work wise are people that are nice and people who really care about music, and I think I'm quite lucky because I don't think many people actually have that. And is, I always think, you know, your manager has to be someone who loves music, but it's not always. And I've had other managers that, like, I've kind of worked with my manager before. I've had to not work with anymore just because they're more about money, or they're only about money, right, or business or whatever. And it's not about that. And if you don't think about it, the chances are more of it will come. Do you know what I mean? If you just go, let's make these tunes for making tunes' sake, people will actually start latching onto it. Whereas if you go, let's make some tunes for money, people will be like, we know you're making tunes for money. We don't want them, you know? But I don't know. I found it quite difficult. I think maybe I had a bit too much honor, you know, or too much kind of like like dignity, do you know? I was kind of surrounded by people who at times didn't seem to.
You can't go into, because I'd imagine you got courted by like a lot of different people at the early days, and people just, were like coming in and going, we're gonna make you a star.
And so what you
Ben
sing,
what do you want? Number one,
literally,
got it.
Exactly. And it was all like, I remember going to meet like some people at this one record label, and they took us out for oysters. And I'm a big lover of food. It's not a lie. But I hate them. I hate oysters. Like, I don't know
I'm
why.
I'm allergic. I'm going to die now.
Yeah. I couldn't. I just couldn't understand like why you'd take an 18-year-old boy out for oysters and think that he was going to go, wow, yeah, here's all of the hard work I put in for the last year. I'm going to give it to you.
But that, the thing about that is, it does work.
Yeah, for sure. But that's the heartbreak of it. But
like
it's changing. But yeah, I've always struggled with it. But I think, you know, it's a game that you have to play, and you can't change the game without playing the game.
It
is what it is.
Change it from the inside.
But
on the positive side, you've got like you mentioned that like, you've got your crew around you.
And like, lucky, man.
You've got your good crew, good team around you. But like when, on the sort of outskirts of just like your main team, I love the sort of five-a-side football team that you've got here, in like Tom Meesh, Kiko Bunn, Jordan Rakai, and Quez.
And you've
worked with them again on this new record project.
This new album. I think, you know, just the same people about is nice. Keeps you. I don't know. I just feel like, you know, the musicians I'm working with are such incredible people, and they're such good friends of mine. You know, like a guy like Jordan Rakai is such. I was at his wedding actually on Friday night. Shout out to him. Hitched.
Congrats.
I feel very lucky to work with musicians like that. You know, it was a big thing. I was thinking the other day about, you know, not saying that it's the same as that, but, and I don't think I'm really maybe part of it like that, but, you know, I was thinking about all these producers I want to work with, you know, and how I wish I could work with Jay Dilla and The Roots and Met Questlove and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, at the time when The Roots were working on You Got Me and that album, Everything Falls Apart, or Things Fall Apart, sorry. They're also like the like Soul Quarians, I think, or like Erykah Badu was working with them, D'Angelo was working with them, whatever. But you know, Erykah Badu wasn't Erykah Badu that we have right now. She wasn't Erykah Badu, but she wasn't like the superstar.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to kind of remind myself that the people I'm working with, you know, they're not necessarily the next Erykah Badu or whatever, but these are my friends, and these are the people that I should be working with, because much like, you know, they wouldn't go, yo, let me like holler up Jordan Rakai and get him over if it was the other way around. They'd be going,
with
Erykah Badu.
You didn't have like Erykah Badu.
So
going back and working with Quincy Jones or something like that.
Exactly. I think that's the thing. It was like, for me, was taking inspiration from that kind of stuff and just appreciating the stuff that I'm doing now with these guys, because what they're doing at the moment is like, it's a moment in music, I think, you know?
You're not phoning up like Mark Ronson or phoning up Danger Mouse Timbaland.
Give me that sweet hit. You know, if they're listening and they want a hit.
Yeah, it's like going...
I can't give you that, but I'd love one. If you've got one, I'll play my mum's
house. Hit me up on a number one. Yeah. And like, you know, the sort of the yin to your yang, the the Barry to your Paul Chuckle, Rebel Clef.
Yeah. My guy.
I love that guy.
He's a hero.
He's been. Since almost day.
It's been cool actually because we like fell out a bit. I like as always when you're working with friends, it's impossible. You start making money together, and it was difficult. And so, my one piece of advice: be careful when you're working with your friends because you care about them a lot, and you need to make sure that you know that you still care about them afterwards. It's a very difficult thing to navigate making money
absolutely.
And splitting it, and you're doing X amount, and this person's doing X amount. We've kind of in a roundabout way made ourselves back to be mates again, but you know it was an important thing because you see it all
the time. Difficult. It's difficult.
It is, man. And you
money
see,
ruins a lot of things. Like
cash ruined everything around me at times, and then it made everything better at other times. You know, and that's what it is. But it's just about appreciating it. You know, you see it a lot with like Tribe Called Quest and Five Dog and Q-Tip, right? Best friend.
That documentary.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. That documentary. And I remember watching that with Rebel and being like, "Well, that's never us." And then, sure enough, a year later, I'm doing this fucking YSL thing, and he's going, "Why are you getting paid this money to hold some fragrance?" And I'm like, "I don't know, but it's not my fault." Do you know what I mean? You can't hold it against me.
Yeah.
But yeah,
Yves Saint Laurent.
Yves Saint Laurent. Yeah.
And like, do you plan on getting back into being the face of Burberry or Fred Perry or X, Y, and Z?
Tell you what, if anybody who's got enough, like the way I see it with that kind of stuff is, you know, if I can make money doing something stupid, if I can sell my face, it's not even that good of a face, but if I can sell my little frog face, then it means that, like, to be genuine, it means that I can make the music I want to make without having to compromise it. If I couldn't make money from doing crazy things like that, stupid things like that, because it's obscene and I shouldn't be able to do things like that. But I can make enough money from that to then be able to sit at home and work on the music that means a lot to me, as opposed to making a music and thinking, geez, this music's got to supply me with X amount of money. It's like quite a privileged position to be able to make money, to make music without worrying about the money it's going to make.
Big time. And you'll always make better stuff that way without the pressure.
That's
on.
The balance, though, I guess.
Touring, how do you find it all, like the vibe of touring, like is that something that you love, being able to take that out every single time?
I like going on tour. I think it can sometimes be a bit draining or grueling. I think it's important. I just think it's quite weird because it's like one of the only art forms where you have to revisit your art every night, you know, like say if you're a painter, you don't have to go back into the headspace you're at to when you painted this dark image of a, you know, whatever. But when you're making music, you have to go back there. And I think sometimes there's a lack of understanding with that when you're on tour and people go, "Why didn't you play this song?" And it's like, "Yo, because I don't want to play that song, because when I played that song, I was really, really sad. I don't want to be that sad ever again," you know?
That must be difficult because, like, a lot of your songs, some of the early songs and some of this is, like, they're so touching and raw. There's certain records that I can't listen to now because they bring up a really sort of heavy emotion.
And it's kind of it's done its purpose for you, you know, and it becomes someone else's. But I think, you know, it's definitely my duty to perform X amount of songs, you know, the light-hearted ones, if there are any of mine. But
there are.
I don't know. I enjoy it. I just think I've got more responsibility now. You know, I have a missus that I miss. I've got a house I've got to look after. I've got my mum's house, my little brother. You know, like soon, hopefully, gonna have a dog. I mean, there's extra bits. I've always found like the further I've grown, the more I leave behind when I go on tour. Do you know what I mean? And so that's the only bit that kind of sucks for me, is just being away from the people I want to share it all with. But I go with Rebel Clef, Tomo. We've got such an incredible group of friends that we go on tour with. There's no like industry buds on the road. It's just mates.
Exactly. So it's nice. The industry guys won't come out of London anyway.
We'll see you at London.
They'll turn up at your Brixton Academy show or whatever.
See you around house if you have 30 guys in the guest list. Never again.
One thing that you've got on tour that when I was like reading earlier on, I was like, I was like doing research earlier on. I was like, I've interviewed you and met you and like we've hung out so many times. So I was like, why am I doing research? I don't think.
We are friends.
But I was like, holy shit. On your rider, you've got one pint of draft Guinness, and I just sat back and I was like, "That is living." Like, as somebody, as you can probably tell, living up to the Irish stereotype is fond of like Guinness. Yeah. Like, you know, Yves Saint Laurent's one thing, but like, you know, being the face of Guinness or something.
That's my dream. But you have to be 26, right, or 25? I can't remember. You have to be like over 25 to advertise alcohol. So
I remember this because
I'm hopeful.
You were.
This has been on the cards for a long time, and every kind of year, like, I get back in touch with Guinness and go, "Hey, don't forget about me. I'm coming." Yeah. That's kind of my big dream is to be in a Guinness advert. Because then I feel like I'll have done everything that I know that would have made my dad proud. I'd have done, you know. I've done so many things that, like, not just for him, but I've been inspired by him. But that's like, if I do that one,
that's the ultimate.
Yeah,
you make a lot of people proud.
Yeah, you know, doing that.
You get starstruck quite easily. Like, I don't get starstruck with musicians at all, but that's because I think it's my job.
Yeah.
But if I was to, like, actually, when I was in the BBC recently, John O'Shea was in there, and I walked past him a couple of times going, oh my God, what do I say?
That's cool.
Yeah, a footballer, even if they're like an under, like, 21 footballer, reserve footballer.
Football, because it's
anything, I'm like, oh my God, it's an alien.
Just because it's like, it was everything I ever wanted when I was younger, and it never happened.
Same, you see, I always wanted to play for Man United.
But it just, like, I've met so many, and I think I'm kind of, weirdly, I'm cool with a few football players, right? But these are, like, legend football players. They're not playing right now. And
who are we talking about? Like, Rio Ferdinand? I'm sorry, I can imagine. You're friends with David Beckham?
Yeah.
And the room goes quiet. How'd that hook up?
He asked me to perform at his, a launch of, like a launch event for one of his, like,
fashion
brand. No, it wasn't for his fashion brand, it was for, like, his grooming brand.
Right.
99. Shout out to David. And then we chatted a bit, and it kind of came to light that he was actually a bit of a fan of my tunes, but not massive. I think his son was or whatever, but
yeah,
you know, we just chatted, and I told him a story about my dad and how he's a big United fan, I was a Liverpool fan, but, you know, I said, thanks for everything, because, you know, football was a big deal in my house, and, you know, but whatever, I just was, I don't know, it was interesting, and I found that he was really into food, and invited me down to one of his fashion shows in the London Fashion Week, and then to another one, and then he went to the Fashion Awards recently, and he invited me to sit on his table, and
amazing.
Like, I don't know, it just, what was crazy is, it's difficult not to get upset about it or not to be emotional about it, because it's like, that was my dad's, like, true hero.
Yeah.
Eric Cantona is the only other guy I'm really cool with, and we text, which is quite crazy.
That's incredible, because I know that you would bring up the Eric Cantona flag with you on stage.
So I told him that story. I said, that's another story. Yeah, I told Eric Cantona that whole story. We're cool, but, you know, and that is also, you know, ridiculous.
This is blowing my mind. I'm a childhood Manchester United fan.
But these are two people that are important. But, like, with David Beckham, sometimes I'm chatting to him, and, like, he went to school, same school as my dad. Like, they're maybe like 10 years apart or five years apart or whatever. But my dad used to do all the things that David Beckham used to do, right? And then I'm sat there chatting to him about, you know, whatever, like, basically nothing. Do you know what I mean? Just saying, like, yeah, you know, super shy, but also still kind of going, you know, we're cool. And I'm thinking about, like, what my dad would think that his son is friends with his hero. And he's in a fancy suit, in a fancy place, drinking fancy beers.
He's so jealous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Like, I want to be there.
Isn't it? It's heartbreaking. It couldn't be, because it's crazy is that if my dad hadn't passed away, I probably would never have met David Beckham or Cantona, because my story would have been different, right?
Your story would have been different, and maybe the music that you made mightn't have resonated
in the same way. It's the
universe. Like,
it's crazy, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, the person who'd enjoy it most doesn't get to enjoy it, so I have to make sure that I enjoy it as much as possible.
Really, like, digging there, and didn't think that, like, you were going to say David Beckham.
Yeah, come on, man. I'm not one of these, you know, one of these every now and again rappers. You know what I mean, I'm a real rapper.
I know. Like,
but I've always wanted to meet, like current players, right? But I don't. Maybe it's because the music I make is not current or whatever. The only person.
I always said, like, footballers have bad taste in music. As a group.
Yeah, so maybe I'm in then. I don't know. Maybe I got a shout. I didn't know that. But no, the only player who's ever really hit me up, like, as actual player, was Daniel Sturridge. Daniel Sturridge followed me when he was at the height of SAS days.
This is like Sturridge dance.
Sturridge and Suarez, yeah. I remember getting that follow and going. And, like, I don't really ever get followed by people who are famous or cool or exciting, because I'm not that cool or exciting, right? And then every now and again, one really niche or one really fucking cool guy will pop up, and I'll freak out, and then for like a week or 2 weeks I'm trying to, like, figure out how to message him. And by that time, they've usually unfollowed me because it's probably by accident. But we chat, actually. I message him. I try and message him before games and be like, yo, good luck for this. Or when he scores a goal, I go, congratulations, great goal. And that, for me, that's enough.
But that's amazing. Well, that's the team you support as well.
Yeah, for me, it's more than enough, man. But the person I'd love to be cool with would be Virgil van Dijk. Or Alexander Arnold, man, because he's, you know.
Yeah.
He's one of our own.
He's one of our own.
Not one of my own. Yeah. I'm not from Liverpool, but...
Virgil van Dijk. I mean, it'd be good going out in a night out with Virgil van Dijk. He's like...
Everything.
You know you would not get any shit.
Yeah, of course.
Nobody's gonna like, throw a glass at you or anything on a night out with him. So we're staring down the barrel now of, like, album two. It's not out at the time of this goes out, but I think it'll be very close to it by the time it does.
I
listened to it this morning. I love it.
Oh, yeah? Oh, I appreciate it.
I really like it.
I don't know if you'd heard it or not. Yeah. Thanks.
How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I feel like it was the best I could do.
Well, it's really fucking good.
Thank you. Yeah, it feels like, you know, I said everything I wanted to say. I worked with all the people that I wanted to, I wanted to work with. I didn't compromise. I didn't work with people that I didn't know. I made sure I only worked with friends again. It just so happens that kind of some of my friends are a bit more, you know, known than before, but it didn't feel like anyone was there. They'd been shoehorned on or forced into a room, you know. Every song was made in a room with people. So, yeah, you know, I'm really proud of it. I think it's, it's like a snapshot of how I feel.
The Georgia Smith track is the current single
that just
came out. And there was a real fun video if you go up on Instagram of, like, you two in the studio creating that.
Yeah.
And it was weird because, like, I'm a big fan of both of yours.
Yeah.
I just how did that come about? Like, is that the same sort of, like, have you been friends for a while, or was that a mutual respect vibe?
I've known her for ages, but not like, I haven't, like, hung out loads. I met her a long time ago, even before I was really Lil Connor, definitely before she was Georgia Smith at this bar. She was like, "Oh, you're Lil Connor." I was like, "Yeah," and chatted or whatever. But then, like, as time went on, I just kept seeing her in places, you know, and then she was just growing in name, and I was like, "Wow, she's really doing well for herself. Mm. This is wicked." And then, yeah, man, like, I can't remember, I bumped into her at some point, and I was like, "You know, we should work on a tune." She said, "Yeah, I'd love to." And we kind of, once we caught wind of each other's music, been like, "Yeah, for sure, why not?"
But that makes sense.
She was so busy, I was so busy, and we kind of looked like brother and sister a little bit, you know, so but, like, finally, so I'd made this tune with Jordan Mackay, we'd written it mostly, it was kind of rough still, and we'd already had Ottolenghi finished, and this other tune, Sail Away, with Charlotte Dave Wilson, that Jordan produced, and he was like, "You know what? I don't really, you know," we're kind of deciding if he should be on two singles or whatever. And he was like, "You know, I've got my own stuff to do." Sorry. For the listener, I just dropped a coaster. I'm embarrassed. But he kind of had his own thing going on. And so I was like, "Okay, well, fuck it. Let me just get in touch with Georgia and see if she'd be up for being part of it." So I sent her the idea. I was like, "Hey, me and Jordan have got this idea for a song. Do you want to be part of it?" She was like, "Yeah, for sure." And then we went studio, and kind of the rest was history. But it was it's nice to make music in the room of people. And it sounds stupid, do you know what I mean? You know, if, like, guys like whoever, like Oasis, would listen to it, go, "Yeah, of course you make the music in the room." Do you know what I mean? But
that doesn't happen.
But these days, it doesn't happen like that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Especially if you're making rap music and you can get beats from whoever. People just send you beats, you rap on them. I can't do that. Oh, I can if I have to, and it's important. But in the nuance, the beauty, the mistake, the thing that you keep, you know, all the things that Georgia did on the song and all the extra little bits she did is in response to what I'm saying, and what I'm putting down is in response to what she's saying, and that's where you have a song that means something.
Yeah,
you know,
it's got a heartbeat to it.
Yeah,
like, we had the specials on the podcast, and I'm not sure whether it's already gone out or it'll come out after. But, like, they made an album with Desmond Dekker and didn't even see him.
Wow.
Do you know, they put it all down and he came in somewhere else and did it.
It just doesn't make any sense. And I think sometimes the beauty of that can work, if that's how you work. Like, I know that MF Doom and Madlib, when they were making the Mad Villain tape, they were one was Nocturnal, one, I think Madlib was Nocturnal. So he'd be up all night making beats. Then he'd go to bed. And then as he was going to bed, MF Doom would come into the studio and record on all the beats. Then he'd go to bed at the end of the night. And then Madlib would wake up and start making more and mixing it.
Yeah.
They never really hung out, but they were in the same space.
Well, The Clash did the same thing. Yeah. Like, Mick Jones and Joe Strummer wouldn't speak to each other for a while. So, like, Joe Strummer would come over Mick Jones' house and post lyrics through the letterbox.
No,
and then he'd just write to it.
Fuck.
Do you know what I mean?
That's wicked, though.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's just
it works for some
of,
people. It doesn't for
just
others.
Contact. I think any sort of contact for me is the best.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it, man, because I still don't know if, as much as I'm happy with it and I feel like it summed up what I want to say, I don't know if it's shit, if it's new, if it's, like, you know, if it's different, if it's the same. I've got no idea if it's...
If you're happy with it, then, like, you've half the battle's won already.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because at the end of the day, at least if it tanks, then I know that I was proud of it.
I don't think it's going to. bet the house on it that it's not. Ben, thank you so much for taking the time out.
It's a true pleasure, man.
For a lovely chat down in Soho, and good luck with the record and all the rest of the whirlwind that comes with.
Thanks very much.